Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
There. Are you happy, Bill?
I'm always happy.
I did it the same way twice.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we've got two fun topics for you today. Kind of similar in an odd way, I suppose. You could make the connection. We have Brad Steiner on first, and that's going to be a lot of fun. We're not really sure what he's going to tell us this time, but it's continuing our discussion of self-defense, but the kind, like I like his quote on here, when your attacker absolutely positively must be stopped immediately.
And not get back up.
And not get back up. No, that's just implied. We added, we added that part. But you know, with everything that's going on these days, this topic becomes more and more and more relevant, and I think more to the forefront of people's thinking. We're no longer walking around, you know, idly thinking everything is fine. It's, you know, coming to a town near you. If it isn't there already, I know ours is starting to look a lot like Thunderdome.
Yeah, it is.
It seems like everywhere you go is looking a lot like Thunderdome.
I think I saw Tina Turner on the way into the building today.
Just say no to midgets, huh?
Yeah.
All right. So, it's not even 10 after. We've already talked about Tina Turner and midgets. And then the second hour, we have Brady, and I think it's Grenier, but I really forgot to ask him how you pronounce it. But he is with BioCore RX, and that is a pharmaceutical company, but moreover than that, it's a recovery program. It actually has the ability to stop the opioid crisis. It's a medication that makes people ill when they take opioids, you know, or use heroin or anything of that family. Also, if they drink. And it's something that instead of a pill you take every day, so they decide, well, today I'd rather get high, so I'm not going to take my pill. It's actually implanted and releases slowly. So it'll go for 4 to 6 months. So that ought to be kind of an interesting deal. Hope you stick with us for that. So swerving back, we will go to self-defense. Professor Bradley Steiner has written over 30 published books. He's the founder and grand master of American Combato. He's the president and CEO of the International Combat Martial Arts Federation and an elite and prestigious organization and internationally recognized close combat, self-defense, and martial arts authorities. And this is my favorite part, actually. I should put like a little star by this one in his bio. He's the former president of the International Stick and Knife Fighting Association in Berlin, Germany. I know, suddenly, you know, you see all the movies in the back of your mind. He's the former Washington State Director for the American Society of Law Enforcement Trainers. He's written numerous magazines, American Handgunner, Combat Handguns, Security Soldier of Fortune, and Cavalier. He's taught special agencies and teams the art of combato, and the teams have specially written manuals created by the professor himself.
That's right.
And there's tons of information. I hope you will join us on the web at some point in time and share it with your friends. We are at wethepeopleradio.us. You can find all of our contact information and, I don't know, archives stretching back into the great beyond on pretty much any topic you can name. And we save them all commercial-free for you for speedy listening and sharing. If you're a Twitter user, please share it on Twitter. We get most of our listeners from Twitter. I don't know why that is exactly. Facebook's a good platform, but seems like Twitter is more engaging. All right. Without further ado.
Now expanded to 280 characters.
I know. I never use it, though. It seems
gauche. You never use it?
No, it seems gauche.
Yeah.
You stop yourself.
Now you're blowy.
Yeah, you stop yourself. Yeah. It's just crazy. So, Brad, what's happening today?
Hi.
Where are we going
to
go?
It's wonderful to be on your show. I was looking forward to it all week.
Well, thanks for being with us.
What I was hoping to discuss a bit was the problem of self-defense for the senior or elderly person, the senior citizen, who unfortunately seems to be getting targeted more and more in the major metropolitan areas. I think it's important that people who are seniors understand not only that they could be targeted and how they could be targeted, which they can learn in a good instruction program, but what to do about it, because many people believe after they pass the age of, 40 or 50, there's just no way they can deal with somebody who's in his late teens or 20s who attacks him, most particularly if there's more than one of them or if they're armed. The truth is, of course, that they can defend themselves, and they can do it quite well, and there are many instances on record where it has been done. There are certain specifics that I like to get across to those who are senior citizens, and being one myself, I'm over 70, so I'm in that category. It's important to understand certain principles. They're not necessarily unique to the senior citizen, but they are very important for the senior citizen to address and understand very, very specifically how importantly they apply to him. Probably the first point is to be very realistic about it. Anybody born in the 1930s, 40s, and possibly even the 50s is probably bewildered and offended at the behavior of many individuals who are of later generation. The rudeness seems to be a part of the way people are brought up almost. It's just common everywhere. It's almost like it's cool to be rude.
No more respect your elders.
The matter is, often a senior can become offended or incensed by that and just feel like speaking up and putting this young idiot in his place. That's a mistake, because you have to use common sense. If you are in your 60s, 70s, or 80s, you don't want a confrontation with someone who just might turn violent. Even if you know how to defend yourself, discretion is the better part of valor, and avoidance is always self-defense technique number one for young or old, but it's particularly important to understand you don't want to precipitate a situation by expressing the fact that a person is misbehaving. They probably don't care. I've never yet heard of anyone being called to account for bad behavior and saying, oh my goodness, I really shouldn't spit on the sidewalk. I really shouldn't mark up this property. I really shouldn't be doing this.
You're right. Using
What's
the finger is bad, my mom
care.
Told
That's
me.
Why they do it.
No, you're absolutely right.
It's true.
If they cared, they wouldn't be doing it in the first place.
Can you imagine? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I give you the finger? That's not the finger I meant. I don't know. Yeah, it is a little bit weird. These days, it seems they're... I don't know. The decorum is...
Oh. Sorry, you can give me the finger, just don't touch me with it.
Well, the idea of being rude doesn't bother people anymore.
I like that one, Bob.
No, you're absolutely right.
It is offensive to anyone who was brought up to be a lady or a gentleman, because it's just not a part of the way we interact civilly. But it is part of the way many people of the later generations, more recent generations, do behave. And violence, since it's rarely, if ever, adequately punished in our society, has become more and more considered okay. I'm angry, I feel upset, so I'll punch somebody, or I'll hit somebody with a stick, or I'll pull a knife. And this goes on all the time.
That's true.
It's not true of everyone, but it certainly happens often enough so that people who are concerned about self-defense, most particularly those who are seniors, understand that avoidance is smart, and they're not going to get anywhere by attempting to teach courtesy to people who have chosen to live more like wild animals.
To the unteachable.
I also think it's very important that weapons be considered, and be considered as the primary means of self-defense by those who are on in years, most particularly those who may be coming to a study of self-defense very late in life. People who have been training all their lives, well, they can probably defend themselves very well. One of my old teachers, the late Charlie Nelson, was able to defend himself very well right up until he retired. As a matter of fact, he was teaching self-defense from his wheelchair after he closed his studio. If you've been at it all of your life, that's one thing. But many people take a course, they start late in life, and weapons are an equalizer. Obviously, I believe you should have weapons legally. I don't think anybody should carry, for example, a firearm illegally. But definitely, people who are seniors should give serious consideration to acquiring, first of all, proper training in safety and gun handling, and then combat training, and then buy a gun, have firearms available as often as you can, wherever you go. Obviously, there are places where you can't carry a weapon, but you should be armed. You need an equalizer, and weapons are tools of self-defense. They enable you to carry out the task of protecting yourself or your spouse or your friend much better than you would do with your bare hands. There are weapons other than firearms, such as knives, although in the West they are considered weapons of the bad guy. They are not really. A knife is a very good weapon. It carries a tremendous psychological advantage. Nobody wants to be stabbed or cut, and they're convenient to carry. A walking stick, with a few hours of instruction, a person can do very serious damage with a walking stick and hold off two or three attackers with relative ease, providing they don't have firearms or other weapons. I think elderly people also should avail themselves of the latest security procedures and methods. Alarm systems, for example. Many people don't think of that until after they've been burglarized or after their home has been violated. But having an alarm system is always a good idea. This is something that a lot of people just don't want to think of. It can be a bit expensive, but I think for the peace of mind that it buys, it's well worth it.
How do you feel about dogs?
Okay, hold on one second.
I love dogs to begin with, and that was one of the things
break,
I
Bill.
Wanted to mention.
Me.
That dogs are not only marvelous deterrents to crime, they can be with some of the larger breeds, like of course the German Shepherds, the Doberman Pinschers.
So dogs in sweaters probably not so
Rhodesian
much.
Rhodesian Ridgebacks.
Darn it.
These breeds are intelligent and will be very formidable adversaries to an assailant. Small dogs can be valuable as well. They could be alarm dogs. They will
got a couple
bark,
of those.
Sometimes scare off intruders. Then there's the companionship. A dog is really a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a good dog, a large, strong dog, you're really walking around with a living deterrent to violence.
That's true. Pick the person with the dog or not the dog. Definitely not the dog.
Yeah.
We got to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Brad Steiner.
And I'm going to run out and take the sweater off of my dog in case I get in trouble. He'll be a little more intimidating.
Take the sweater off my dog while you're at it.
Yeah.
They're out there covered over by blankets wearing sweaters in the car. Obviously a huge deterrent. Not Brad's theme song.
No.
Well, kind of. Because if you can get away without fighting about it, I guess it's better.
Mm. Walk away a winner.
Exactly.
Yep.
Okay, so dogs, sticks. I just want to point out, Brad, by the way, dogs and sticks, they do go together. Bill's dad, in his later years, became masterful with a cane.
Yes.
He could hit the dog from,
oh
I don't know, 10 yards out.
Oh, sure.
He was unbelievable. So, I mean, even though people, he had all sorts of health problems, too, but he was swift with a cane. Swinging it, I mean.
So, so you're a believer in a well-trained dog?
Oh, yes. I love dogs. They're very reliable defenders of the home, certain breeds, and they're wonderful companions. I certainly would advocate dogs, and providing, of course, you could take proper care of them. A very important thing that I would emphasize and do emphasize if I'm teaching someone who's on in years is to abandon compassion, mercy, and human feelings when they find themselves in need of self-defense. There seems to be a tendency, by some fluke, I was never afflicted by it, for older people to develop much more compassion and sensitivity toward wrongdoers. And that can work against you. When someone attacks you, they are to be treated with the same mercy that you would treat a polio virus. They are attackers, and it is very dangerous to hesitate to do something or to do something that is inadequate to stop the person. Sometimes an older person might feel they don't want to hurt this youngster too much. Well, the youngster doesn't seem to care too much about hurting the older individual, and self-defense requires that you take a no-nonsense approach and be pretty aggressive and pretty vicious when you must defend yourself.
Yeah,
with this, of course, it's necessary to learn destructive and simple techniques. Now, in our system, American Combato, that's all we teach. But there may be people living a distance who will be enrolling with some other teacher, and if the techniques are not simple and destructive, they won't be repeatable under tremendous stress.
Mm.
And if they aren't, then what's the good of them? You may learn techniques that look pretty. You can learn techniques that seem to work effectively when you are practicing them with a cooperative partner. But the techniques that you use when you're attacked by someone who is younger and stronger and bigger than you are have to be pretty vicious. They have to do damage. And I don't see any reason to apologize for this. I don't really care what happens to a violent attacker. But to counteract what might be in some older citizens a tendency to be compassionate and merciful with an assailant, I want to make the point that that is, in effect, cooperating with and assisting the attacker. You have to be aggressive. For example, somebody is blocking your path and somebody wants to rob you. You put your hands up in a pleading gesture, please don't hurt me. And then suddenly, with your hands raised, you ram your fingers forward into the person's eyes. Now, that sets him up to have his leg broken by a low kick or for you to access your weapon. But this is the kind of thing that you should be ready, willing, and able to do. If you think you're going to get somebody wrapped up in a hold or pin him and bring him to the police station,
never.
You're crazy.
Yeah, it's never going to happen.
It doesn't work for a young, strong person. It's not going to work for someone in his 70s and 80s who has just now taken to the course of training in self-defense.
Yeah. I think that only works in TV.
You know, that's really good advice. My father was in law enforcement his entire life, and, you know, he basically always taught us the same thing, was that if you have to use violence, use it in a fashion that puts your attacker in enough pain to where they don't want to fight anymore, or they'll back off and leave you alone. But you have to deploy that immediately, or you're going to get hurt. And I think what you're saying is spot on.
Yeah. It's very sad that this even has to be addressed as a subject. When you think about it, the quality of a society in some ways can be judged by how the very young and how the very old are treated. And in our society today, pardon me, unfortunately, you see hideous abuses of the young, and you see hideous abuses of the elderly. Well, there's one thing in the New York Daily News just the other morning. This veteran, literally dying in a hospital bed, was asking for help, or he was thirsty or something, and the attendants in the hospital were laughing at him.
Oh, my gosh.
Now this, to me, is inhuman. And this is in a hospital.
Right.
So if a hospital worker can sink to the level of pure scum, then you can imagine what those who choose to be predators can sink to and how they might treat people. It's a very serious problem. It can be dealt with, but it has to be dealt with appropriately and decisively. It isn't necessary for a person to train to get a black belt. It isn't necessary for a person to learn many hundreds of techniques. It isn't necessary for the person to be of inordinate strength. But it is necessary that the person acquire an attitude whereby he is without, or she is without, mercy or compassion for an attacker, and is ready, willing, and able to use skills that are brutal.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I advocate and have been advocating since the 1970s methods based upon what was taught during the Second World War. And these were war-proven skills. They were taught to people who, in many instances, had no familiarity with violence at all and needed to be taught in a relatively brief period of time before they were sent off to a war zone. In the street, you are at war when somebody attacks you. And it is imperative that you understand that so that at the very moment you are attacked, there's a minimum period of astonishment and shock. You cut it to a bare minimum, and you react as quickly and as ferociously as possible. This is the real world. This is what you need to do if you're attacked. It's very similar to these lunatics who start trouble on airplanes.
Hmm.
They should just be stopped without mercy and instantly. And in some cases, that is true. They are being stopped that way, as they should be. You have to recognize the degree of the threat. There are people who get maimed and killed when the attacker's intention is not to do that, just because they fall and hit their heads or some other accident occurs during the course of an attack and they are severely injured or they're killed. There's no reason to hesitate when you're under attack, and most especially if you are on in years, perhaps not in the best of condition. Maybe you have some health problems. You can't slug it out with some punk in the street. You have to finish it quickly. Weapons is the best way, but obviously you can't always have a weapon, and you should have confidence in your hands and feet. And this can be acquired with relatively little trouble. It just takes an attitude, and that's a very important part of self-defense training, to imbue that attitude in every student, young or old. It's just, I wanted to mention this particularly for the senior citizens, because I've noted in going over some news reports throughout the country, this is becoming an increasingly difficult problem. And it's a disgraceful problem, but we have to face it. It needs to be addressed.
Do you think people are more I guess, more vulnerable in a large group setting or by themselves? I mean, I guess instinctively you'd think, like, being by yourself, getting caught, you know, on a street by yourself with somebody who was coming after you. But a lot of times in these, you know, kind of big city atmosphere, you get a whole bunch of people there and people wind up watching and not helping.
Yeah.
Does it help reaction time at all?
I would say that what that phenomenon indicates is that all of us need to understand if and when we are under attack, we are on our own.
Hmm.
At least until the police arrive, and they're not going to get there until after the fact.
Yeah, because I
you're
think
on
there's,
your own.
Yeah, there's a
now,
there's a larger.
Well, there have been cases where people have intervened, but not enough.
Right.
And then again, there is it's not 100% the fault of those who fail to intervene, since this is we're lawsuit crazy. People
right.
get sued. People
yeah,
get into
that's
trouble.
True.
For doing the right thing, and they're afraid of that. They're afraid of that.
Yeah, there's.
But
there's,
I'll tell you, I think if I saw a police officer under attack, if I saw an elderly person under attack, I'm going to stop whoever it is attacking that person.
Well, if I'm ever under attack, I hope you're there to see it, actually, because I think that would be kind of awesome.
There's a certain sense of responsibility, I think, that we all need to have, and that is, if we want a safe city or town or wherever we live, we really have to take it seriously when someone is violated, and we have to, in certain ways, watch out for each other. If you notice that your neighbor's home is being... If there are people hanging around his home, it's being checked out, call the police. Let them check it. If, just be aware. Be aware that there's somebody in the world besides yourself. And show some concern for the safety of the community. In very large cities, that's almost unheard of.
Yeah.
I know I come from a very large city, New York, but it's a difficult situation, and I think individuals should take a greater sense of, I'm not going to let this go on.
Yeah.
If I see it. If somebody is violating someone, I'm not going to let it go on. Now, that doesn't mean you should jump in whenever you see two people fighting. That can get you in tremendous trouble, and it's a stupid thing to do. But if you see two or three teenagers, and this has happened, you see two or three teenagers pushing an elderly lady around, this is not a domestic squabble.
Right. And you would hope that most people would be, aware enough that they would do something, but you hear all the time about how they don't.
People are afraid to get involved, and they'll go call for help, but I don't want to get in the middle of it.
I'm going to take you down right now, Bill, because we have to take a really quick break. I'm going to go put Bill in a headlock and try that out, see if it works here.
All right, we're going to take a break, and I'm going to put my guard up.
I'm still trying the headlock. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back with our guest, Brad Steiner.
All right, bring it on, sister. Here we go.
So much younger than today,
I never needed
anybody's help in any way.
Now
these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured.
Now I find
I've changed my mind and opened up the doors.
Help.
The ultimate self-defense song.
That's right. Hey, Brad, I got to thinking, what about... like improvised weapons, you know,
like car keys,
things like that.
Well, the use of improvised weapons should accompany all self-defense training. For example, I do that all the time. I teach people how to use virtually anything at hand, and virtually anything you've got in the vicinity can be used as a weapon. The important thing is to think of these things in terms of weaponry. An object can be used to stab, to cut, to hit, to strangle, as in a lamp cord. It can be used to distract. If you have a magazine in your hand,
shiny object,
and it's not rolled up, don't waste time trying to roll it up when someone's coming at you. Fling the magazine in his face. If it's rolled up ahead of time, it can be used to jab into the throat or into other body parts that are vulnerable. This is a good weapon. And this is integral, and it should be integral, to any good course of training in self-defense. There are no rules here. Just because your opponent does not have a weapon in his hand doesn't mean, A, that he doesn't have a weapon in his pocket, or B, that you should limit yourself and not use a weapon against him.
Right.
How do you feel about running? How do you feel about running? It seems like whenever,
if you can.
It seems like people who fall down and old people aren't very good at running.
Running away is that, generally speaking, violent offenders will target you when they've got you in a position where getting away is not feasible.
That makes sense.
They will follow you, or they'll monitor your activities, or just approach you because you're in a vulnerable position. And it's, running away is a great thing to do if you can do it. Sometimes you can't run away because you're with a companion who can't run, and you have to stay with someone who depends upon you for protection. I'm all for avoidance. I always tell people our priorities are this: avoidance, preemption, and then counterattacking if you've been too late and an attack has gotten through. But avoidance is self-defense technique number one. And not only running physically, but if you can, and you're dealing with someone who is verbally trying to provoke you or who is clearly immature and out of control, you can sometimes disarm this person and make it clear that you're really not worth fighting with. You could tell the person you have a health condition. Say anything. You don't owe honesty to a nut. I'll just tell the person, you just got out of the hospital. You have a heart condition. Please don't bother you. Now, if he says, I don't care, and he attacks you, you certainly got the element of surprise in your favor, because you should be doing a pretty good job for a cardiac patient if you know what to do.
Yeah. But they won't expect it.
Lying beats running.
Yeah, yeah.
That actually makes sense. I didn't really think about that. Do they care? It seems like a lot of our people these days are, obviously different technique for this kind of stuff, but God, a lot of these people are just on drugs, you know? They're not lucid criminals.
There's no reasoning with them, and that's, I think,
you can see the
what Brad's saying is so true. I mean, these people are dangerous, and you're going to really be hurt.
Whatever saves you from harm.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, is techniques that teach you what to do. It's also attitude that teaches you how to view things. And it's behavior that sometimes contradicts what comes naturally.
Mm.
It's very easy, for example, if you're on the road, you're driving along, and for whatever reason, another motorist becomes angry at you and they make some rude gesture or scream at you. It's very easy to gesture back, to follow that car if they speed off. But all of that's very foolish. So the person made a gesture. So he said something. Who cares?
Right.
The sooner he leaves and the sooner you get out of there, the better. You don't want to deal with a person like that. On the other hand, it also has to be clear, and this is really one of the things that I emphasize with students, once someone endangers you, once they make it clear that they intend you harm, it's time to act and act fast. And you need to understand that means attacking the eyes, it means attacking the throat, it means breaking someone's leg, it means doing things that are very, very destructive and that you normally would never think of doing to anybody. But this is not normal. A situation like this is not normal at all.
Yeah, I think in most people's lifetimes, this would never happen.
A woman is at a tremendous disadvantage if she's dealing with a man who intends her harm. And the very second that this guy puts a hand on her, if she doesn't know who he is, he has no business doing that. She has got to assume that this is a serious situation and get him off of her and then get out of there. She's got to do that. She can't rely upon nice words or gentle moves. If a situation is starting to become serious, it requires a serious solution. If you're out with your family and a couple of punks approach you and you can't avoid them, you can't walk away, they're not going to leave, and you realize that they intend you harm and they initiate a physical action, well, you have to stop them decisively. And this is another thing, something that's very popular in the martial arts today and which is utterly useless, is the idea of pain compliance, control holds, and submission holds. This is for competition and sport. In some cases, the police have need for that. But this has no place in serious self-defense. What stops a serious attacker is massive shock to the central nervous system or cessation of breathing. Now, that's very drastic. It sounds extreme, and it is extreme. And that's what a person has to learn how to do to cause in an attacker. Now, I'm not only talking about a senior citizen. I'm talking about a teenager who gets jumped by a few punks or anybody else who is facing an attack and feels that he is in danger or she is in danger. Violence is not something to be played with. A lot of the skills that are taught with political correctness in mind. And as far as that goes, I can't even use the kind of language I'd like to criticize political correctness. It's outrageous to impose such lunacy upon a person who's concerned about his or her safety. Politically correct my foot. You do what you have to do. And if your neighbors don't like how you defended yourself, that's their problem.
Yeah.
You do what you need to do to defend yourself. An attacker gets what he deserves. There's nothing forcing a person to initiate violence against a victim. Nothing. This is a chosen act, and when it's chosen by someone, it has to be dealt with and dealt with decisively.
Yeah, that's... I think that's really
well. All these things are ramping up. We're seeing it ramp up in our communities, and I think this is. I mean, I'm what 56, so I'm not. Am I actually a senior citizen? Do I count as a senior citizen?
I think so. Yeah,
in some circles, yes.
In some circles, yeah. Okay. So I'm a senior citizen, and I do. I think about it. You know, do I go to the post office now? Well, you know, it's after dark. We have a lot of homeless loiter around the post office, and I'm not exactly shrinking violet. But I do curtail my activity depending on the time of day, depending on where I'm going.
Well, you have situational awareness, and I think that's something we could probably hit on a little bit is people have to be much more aware of their surroundings.
And, you know, your towns are changing. That's
dangerous enough going to this downtown post office in the daytime.
Yeah, I know. That parking lot there's become a problem.
You're certainly smart to use discretion, for example.
You just don't want to go there. Hey, Brad, we have to take a really quick break.
Get gas for your vehicle at a crowded, safe station
daytime.
In broad daylight.
Yep. Or the one by your house that's totally deserted, like ours. There's nobody within miles, which is great.
You want to make sure that you use common sense.
So uncommon these days.
If you see police lights flashing down the block, don't go down the block.
Exactly. Yep. We'll be right back.
Well, I hit him hard right between the eyes, and he went down, but to my surprise, come up with a knife and cut off a piece of my ear. But I busted a chair right across his teeth, and we crashed through the wall and into the street, kicking and a gouging in the mud and the blood and the beard. I tell you, I've fought tougher men, but I really can't remember when. He kicked like a mule and he bit like a crocodile. I heard him laugh and then I heard him cuss, and he went for his gun and I pulled mine first. He stood there looking at me and I saw him smile and he said, "Son, this world is rough and if a man's going to make it, it's
got to
be tough."
That's a good theme song for you, Brad. Uh-oh.
Hello?
There he is. I was going to say, that's a good theme song for you. And
the immortal Johnny Cash.
And he ends victorious. Before we were so rudely preempted by capitalism there, situational awareness. People, you think old people are better at it than young people? You know, with all the phones and the distraction?
I think it's an individual.
They get lulled into submission?
I don't think that you can generalize. I really don't. I do know that it's an important thing to address in training, though. And by the way, there's one other thing I really would like to emphasize for anybody, and that is, it's difficult to imagine that anybody can't see the value of learning to defend themselves. But people tend to procrastinate in actually taking steps to do it. That can be a very serious mistake.
Yeah.
If you identify that this is something that is of value, if you agree, learn. Take up self-defense. Learn. Take some steps to learn. Find out what you need to know before you need to use it. It's too late to learn how to defend yourself once you're attacked. And the process of learning effective self-defense is not the same as the process of becoming a competitor in martial arts or a classicist who trains 3 or 4 hours a day. It's a matter of simply learning basic fundamental skills that have been proven in war to work, and acquiring a sufficient amount of skill in using them so that you have the confidence that should an emergency arise, you're equal to it. But don't procrastinate. If you believe that it's a valuable thing to learn, learn it now.
Hey, Brad, in our last couple of minutes, give people some information about your classes and how they can... We kind of assumed that everyone listened to previous shows we've done with you, which is wrong and bad. Give them a little promotional on what they can do from home.
Well, people can learn from me personally. Either I give 6 classes a week in Seattle, plus private instruction 7 days a week. I also have a DVD course that is very comprehensive. People can use and learn at home. It was prepared with techniques shown very carefully and clearly and slowly so that anyone can learn them just as though there was a teacher present. But whether or not you come to me, I'm not the only good teacher. I think I'm pretty good, and I know my associate teacher, Mark Bryans, is very good. But it's important that people learn self-defense. And if anybody is interested, they can, may I give my phone number
yes,
here?
Yes, please. Whatever you'd like to give them.
It's area code 206-523-8642. And you can call 24 hours a day. Just leave an alternative number or numbers where I can call you back. Very often I'm not able to grab the phone when a call comes in because I'm busy teaching or doing something else. But I'll call you back.
Give it to us again, Brad, real quick.
Sorry?
Give us the number one more time, please.
Sure. Area code is 206-523-8642. And I've got all sorts of
perfect
mental conditioning programs available on using self-hypnosis. We've got technical training and on DVDs and... If you want to learn, the opportunity is there. And I just urge people, don't procrastinate, because in an emergency, there's no time to learn anything.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Professor Brad Steiner. We've got all your information on the website. We look forward to hearing from you again.
Thank you, and please have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
You too. Absolutely. You're listening to We the People. We'll be back for a second hour here. Hope you'll join us. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And, wow, Bill's in full comfort mode here.
Well, this is a serious subject.
Bill's all mulled in for comfort, so we can talk about drug addiction.
Drug addiction.
But you know what? Usually when we talk about stuff like that, there's no answer. Today's show is all about the answer. It's very little about the problem, which is kind of awesome. And, bottom line, you don't have to rely on us for that, because we have an expert with us. His name is Brady... what was it again, Bob?
Granier.
Very tricky.
Granier.
It's G-R-A-N-I-E-R. And I was like...
Didn't you take French in school?
I was like, uh-oh, I could go anywhere with this. This is not good, and I forgot to ask him yesterday. Oh, my goodness. And the website for him is beataddiction.com. Catchy title, easy to remember. And a little background, which explains the pronunciation. He was born and raised in the heart of Cajun country in southeast Louisiana, where he started working at the age of 11. So Brady's no lazy guy here. Working at the age of 11 to help support his single mom and his younger brother. After graduating with honors from high school, he attended college at Nicholls State University in Thibodaux, Louisiana, earned his bachelor's in nursing in 1995. And and then a horn went off. What was that? We've got some odd feedback happening here.
Brady,
have you been overtaken by a horn?
I'm here. Sorry about that. Something was happening with my phone.
Oh, good. At least it wasn't us. we just wanted to know where the horn was coming from. We typically have we're kind of near the fire department, so a lot of times we get little siren sounds, but horn was new. So let's see, I was looking at the little bio here. So you became a home health nurse, you were in ER, the ICU, you did all sorts of stuff, and then somehow you wound up being a traveling nurse, which made you go to California, which I thought was kind of funny. Did you travel to California to be a nurse, or were you just a traveling nurse when you were moving to California?
I wanted to get out of my little town of Louisiana, and that was one way to do it, was become a traveling nurse. And the plan was to, you know, hop, skip, and jump around the country and fill in for the nursing shortage that's everywhere, or was at the time. So my first stop was Southern California, and I'm still here 21 years later.
And you were at the ER in L.A., so obviously you weren't bored while you were there. I'm sure that was a busy, I don't know. And is that what got you into this?
Well, ERs are, you know, everywhere you go, the ERs have their busy times, and they also have their slow times, too. it's not always like you see on TV, but when it is busy, it can be crazy.
Yeah, I picture ER in LA as nonstop.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Revolving door.
Uh huh. Exactly. Why even have doors? So what?
Right.
What led you into the world of drugs? The pharmaceutical end.
Interestingly, I left my nursing career, I think it was late 90s or around 2000 or so, I can't even keep up anymore, but I'd left it altogether, and I was an entrepreneurial person, so I just started dabbling in other things in the internet when that became something, and, I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and there's a lot of opportunity here, so I just somehow I landed in the radio business. So I had a lot of friends that worked in radio, just coincidentally, over the years I made friends with people that were managers or salespeople or some of the on-air talent, and so kind of fell into radio and did that for about 11 years or so, and climbed the ladder at that company, big company called Clear Channel, which is now iHeartMedia. They're all over the country.
Oh, yeah.
And the world, for that matter. But I was always the healthcare category captain, because when you're a nurse or a doctor, you are the go-to person in your family, when your friends, for any health issues that people have. So similarly at work, I was the go-to guy for that, and so eventually, they named me the healthcare category captain. So any potential advertisers in the radio space that was healthcare related usually came across my desk. So sales reps I'd become the business director of business development over the years. I advanced to that position. So sales reps would bring their potential advertisers to me, and I would vet them out and go on meetings, and I can kind of talk with the doctors that were potentially advertising whatever services they were. So what happened was, one of my sales reps at the time, his brother was an alcoholic, and so he was searching for answers for that, and came across this little clinic in Santa Ana, California, that was doing this implant. And I had never heard of anything like it. Of course, I'd been out of the healthcare field for quite some time, and I learned a little bit more about that implant and what the medication was inside of that implant, did my research, and just trying to figure out why hadn't I heard of this when I was in healthcare. And because it turns out it was available back then.
Oh, wow.
So I did my due diligence and learned more about it, was intrigued by it, because at first it sounded like a scam to me, that there's an implant that stops people from drinking.
Why isn't everyone using
implant?
It
just didn't make any sense to me. Couldn't put the two and two together. So, until you educate yourself. So I did, and I met the founders and the owners of the clinic, and met a bunch of patients that had gone through, and it was their miracle. It's what they tried everything else, and this was the thing that worked for them. So you kind of get addicted to the space, and when you see some miraculous turnarounds, you want to be involved and you want to help somehow. So we at iHeart, our Clear Channel at the time, took a pretty good interest in what they were doing, because we hadn't seen anything like it. So we helped them. I helped them in advising, and they became an advertiser as well, for which was great, and we got the word out for them. But I just got more and more intrigued by what they were doing, met more and more patients, and decided that, hey, I wanted to do more. And long story short, after two or three years of kind of getting to know the owners of that clinic down there, they asked me to come on and help them run the company, because they just weren't, they had a great product, but they just weren't, they didn't know how to get it out there. And they were just having this one clinic, and they really needed help. So I was at a point in time in my life where I was able to take that jump and leap from a solid career with a steady paycheck and benefits and all these great things at a big company to this little startup sort of company that just happened to be public as well, which didn't make a lot of sense. That's a whole other story. But that's how I got attracted back into this and pulled back in. And so now I was able to, kind of combine my healthcare background with my media and business experience over the 11 years, and then came over to the company, and we decided to reshape it and take this program that we're doing, that they were doing in one center, and improve it, and then distribute it around the country so that more healthcare practitioners and patients could have access to it. And we'll get, I'm sure we'll get into what that program is here shortly.
Yeah, that's kind of neat. It's interesting how people's lives take these little
turns. How long has that implant technology been around?
Over 20 years.
Well, no kidding.
This is nothing new. It's becoming more known, but it's been one of the best kept, it's been a secret, not because those who are doing it haven't tried to beat down the doors and raise their hand and scream that, hey, look over here, this works. It's just a lot to cut through and break through, and it's changing now because of the opioid epidemic. You know, the epidemic, as bad as it is, there's a lot of good from it, which you have to take from it, all these bad situations, right? And that is now more than ever in the history of addiction. Addiction is now becoming more and more recognized as a disease and not a moral failing, which is a monumental thing to happen.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So because of that, you know, it's always been a disease, but now people that previously thought it was something, you know, it was a choice, now are seeing the light. And that's changing how we treat a disease. Once something's a disease, it's no longer, you treat diseases with medications. That's part of how you treat and manage disease. Because before it was actually considered a disease, these medications, which is implant falls under, just didn't make sense to give someone who was abusing a substance another substance. So that's all changing in front of our eyes right now. I mean, that's what's happening. So this crisis has, you know, alcoholism is still a much, much bigger problem. So this opioid epidemic, because we're now seeing this as a disease and treated with medications, it's going to, or beginning to have will have a profound effect on other addictions as well, such as alcoholism. You know, you can't say that opioids is a disease without saying alcoholism is not a disease. So this is a good thing. The good from all of this is that you're going to see changes in how these things mm-hmm. are treated and managed and looked upon.
And the implant, I'm still kind of fascinated by that. Where do they put it?
Well, it goes in the, typically, there's a few options on where it can go. For the most part, it's implanted in the lower left or right quadrant of the abdomen, sort of maybe like where you might have an appendectomy scar.
Right.
Some it can be put in other places, but you typically are putting it where there's adipose tissue, fat tissue, because it's a very minor procedure. You're probably no more invasive than just getting stitches put in.
How big is it?
You
know,
you, what's that?
How big is it?
Well, there's several different types, but for the most, you know, typically they may be a centimeter in diameter by a centimeter or so. So maybe like the tip of your, you know, small, you know, pinky finger.
Okay.
So they're large. Well, they are large pellets. So it's
right.
not really. So they use the word, you hear the word implant, and when you think implant, you're thinking some device that
right.
needs to be
has
removed.
It has to be reloaded.
It's really not. It's really pellets that are implanted.
Okay.
And they completely dissolve. They don't.
Oh.
They do not need to be removed. There's
okay.
other implants out there that have. They need to be removed, but this particular implant, or these implants have been used for over 20 years, they completely dissolve, so they do not need to be removed. But the good thing is they can be removed if they need to.
Okay.
So they're easy to remove if, for some reason, you have to. Now, what's in the implant is the question.
Well, let's hit that in just a second. We have to take a quick break. But yeah, I'm real interested in how this.
I didn't tell Bill anything I learned from you yesterday. I knew. So he says, it's funny listening to him ask you questions. It's like, oh, I just asked all these yesterday. I already know that.
All right, let's take a break because I want to get back on this.
This is
very
fun.
Interesting.
And we can pick up wherever you like, whatever makes sense. We'll be back with our guest, and we'll be talking about implants, but not the kind you think. And has the potential to really solve the opioid and alcoholism issue for folks. So if you have a friend or a family member and we're all headed into Thanksgiving, be thinking about that. This could be great information for them. You can find all the intel on this on our website, wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
So many lies, you twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
They tried to make me go to rehab, I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no. Try to make me go to rehab. I won't go, go, go.
Maybe she should have gone to rehab.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so Brady, we realized we kind of got you, off to the races.
Yeah, there. I kind of jumped ahead there a little bit. So.
Oh, curious. So, anything you feel like people should know before we march ahead, please feel free. We got all exuberant.
No, I'm. We'll follow your lead.
We got a million questions.
So this is a like a pellet that's implanted under your skin or in the tissue, and it slowly dissolves. And how long does it last?
That's a good question. There's variability in them. So there are a few different types of implants out there. And they all generally are made of the same thing. It's the same active ingredient, naltrexone. And we can get into details of what naltrexone is in a bit. But it will vary. There are some versions, some varieties that may last a couple months. There are some varieties that will last up to 6 months and anywhere in between. So our particular program, we have 3-month variety. And then we also have another one that will last several months, maybe the 4 to 6 month range. You really can't tell, you can't come out and say specifically how long they last because it could range in each individual's metabolism. Mm-hmm. So there's really no, hey, it's going to last this long in you, and you, and you, and you. It varies per patient. So that's all part of the patient's management with the doctor and tracking. And we have a whole tracking program. So there's all those kinds of protocols with that. So it's not just, just putting implants in people and patting on the back and saying, congratulations, you're cured.
Right.
It's not that at all.
So
to answer your question, it's several months is probably the best way to answer that, several months.
Okay. And is the ingredient the same ingredient for alcohol as it would be for opioids?
Yes.
Oh.
So naltrexone is the ingredient. And naltrexone is a very old medication. We don't own naltrexone, just to make sure everyone's on the same page here. Naltrexone was created, I think, in the 60s. And it was FDA approved in 1985 or 84, 85 for opioids. So what they call an antagonist. And it basically blocks the same receptors in your brain that opioids attach to. And it has a stronger affinity for it. I'm sure everyone's familiar with the, and they're confused a lot of times. Everyone's familiar with the drug naloxone, which is the opioid, the heroin antidote. For overdose reversal.
Oh, okay.
Naloxone,
okay.
You may hear Narcan's the spray.
Narcan.
That's the big pop. That's what's popular right now. Unfortunately, everyone's carrying these because of how bad it really is out there. So that Narcan is a brand name. Naloxone is the generic drug that's in Narcan. It's a cousin to naltrexone. So they're both antagonists. So if someone's overdosing, they get the naloxone or the Narcan, and it blows all of those opioids off of those receptors. And so it basically throws them into withdrawals to save their life.
And that's an injection.
And so breathing comes back.
That's an injection, a needle injection?
It's an injection or a nasal spray. It comes in a couple different versions.
Okay.
How it's administered. But it's very short-acting. Like, that may last a couple of hours. But it's enough, you know, we're saving someone's life. That's not treatment. That's just saving someone's life.
Mm-hmm.
Naltrexone is a cousin to naloxone. So basically, instead of blowing off the opioids off the receptors, the naltrexone is in the body and it's latching on to those receptors and it has a stronger magnetism, let's call it, for those receptors. So it just, it covers up the hole, let's say, and then it stays there. And if you take opioids, those opioid molecules can't engage with those receptors. They just kind of wash off like water off a duck's back.
So there's no effect.
And it can't, so you can't get high and you can't overdose as long as you have therapeutic levels in the bloodstream and as long as someone's not shooting up copious amounts of heroin to try to overcome the blockade. It's possible, but usually it would require so much heroin that they couldn't afford to do it anyway. So it gives that protection. So that's kind of the best way to describe kind of how naltrexone works. That's how it works for opioids. Now, your question was alcohol. It was all of the mechanisms of why it helps for alcoholism are still not even that known. It was later FDA approved for alcoholism in the mid-90s, and it's not going to stop someone from getting inebriated or drunk if they drink when on the medication. It also doesn't cause someone to get sick if they drink while on the medication, unlike that's antabuse. It's another medication that makes people sick when they drink if they're taking antabuse. But what it's doing, naltrexone kind of works to block any, it could block many different types of obsessive compulsive disorders and cravings. Mm. So it works a little differently with alcohol. So it will stop the craving cycle, or it can minimize the craving cycle, and then it blocks the euphoric effects of drinking.
Oh,
so
wow.
If you were to drink, you just don't get the buzz. So it takes the pleasure of the drinking away.
Literally takes the fun out of it.
You get drunk, lose your faculties, pass out, hangover, all the bad stuff you keep. Oh. You don't get the good stuff.
Okay.
So it literally takes the fun out of drinking.
So I kind of see the advantage of an implant over taking a pill. You don't have a choice. Once that's implanted, there's no forgetting to take it or not taking it and going to a party or, you know, that sort of activity. Once it's implanted, you're committed.
Correct. You're right. Yes, because, look, this medication has been around, as I said earlier, mid-80s, mid-90s, in a pill form, a once-a-day pill form.
Right.
And if people were compliant, then there wouldn't be a need for these long-term sustained-release products, or be less of a need. But you're right, you hit the nail on the head. You have to take it every day. So every day when you wake up, you have to decide, do I want this pill or do I want my best friend, which is sometimes that drink or that drug of choice. There's a party coming up. The holidays are coming up. I'll just not take it now. So that's the problem. With the medication itself works fantastic if it's in your body.
Right.
And that's why the sustained release, just like you said, it takes rid of the, you have to make the decision once, and then once it's in you, you have that window of opportunity to then deal with the underlying reasons for the addiction and develop tools to avoid the stressors in life, those triggers that happen, so that once the implant wears off, then you hopefully by that time will be better equipped to deal with life.
Now, you said the lasting effect depends on a person's metabolism. What are the downsides? What are the side effects of this drug?
Good question. Well, there's nausea that can happen and vomiting, which usually is minimal and self-contained in the first couple of days. You know, naltrexone is, a lot's happening and changes are happening. But it's the same, basically the same sorts of side effects that you would get from the oral form and the implant form. But nausea, vomiting, maybe some insomnia. And again, most of them are self-limiting. They may need some comfort meds or something like that. But for the most part, it's very safe. It's a very safe medication.
Would a person be advised to take the pill form first to see how their body is affected by it before they went to the extreme of doing an implant?
That's a good question. It depends on the doctor. Every doctor practices medicine their own way. For opioids, for example, before anyone can be on naltrexone in any form, they have to be detoxed and clean from opioids. Because remember the naloxone that's reversing the overdose? Well, if you put naltrexone, or someone swallows naltrexone, gets a shot of it or implant or whatever form it may come in, and they still have opioids in their system, it's going to knock those opioids off of those receptors, and it's going to send them into withdrawal, which is very uncomfortable.
Right.
Not as much dangerous as it is uncomfortable. And that's a miserable thing. So they must be detoxed before they can get on to that. So to answer your question, when it comes to giving someone naltrexone, that's an opioid user, they will usually give them what they call a challenge. They can either do it with naloxone or with naltrexone because they're both antagonists, and give them a little bit by mouth and see, like, not a normal dose, and see if they go into like little minor withdrawals. They can it's what they call a challenge, you know, naltrexone or naloxone challenge.
Mm.
Of course, they also confirm usually with blood tests to make sure, but they still sometimes will give this challenge. With alcoholism, they need to be detoxed too, but it's usually, that's not as difficult usually as it is for opioids. It's a shorter period of time. But again, some doctors may try, a lot of people who get naltrexone implants, they've usually tried some other form of naltrexone before and just couldn't remain compliant. They liked how it worked on them, but they just couldn't stay compliant.
Right. And that gets back to the whole mental behavioral problem, the underlying problem of why they drink to begin with. So yeah.
Correct. So it doesn't get rid of all those things, which is where the behavior modification comes in.
Yeah, well, look, this is one of these things where every case is different.
Yeah.
We've seen people get implants and bail, which is not recommended, just bail on getting any sort of behavioral support and do fine. You know, so it's just every situation is different. Why were they, why were they addicted to begin with? Was it a physical pain that started this? Was it recreational? Was it, was it a injury where, if you break your leg and you got an opioid, but you didn't, your life was great before that. You had no issues psychologically and you get hooked physically. Does that person need the long-term behavioral support, or do they just need to be clean and just never use it again, or have minimal support? Those are extreme. So there could be all sorts of extremes. That's why each case is different, and that's why they're under the care of a doctor and hopefully counselors, and they can treat this individual as they need to be treated. So each case, there's no one size. This is not a one size fits all or a magic bullet. This is a great tool or more weaponry to combat this crisis. But if it's in you, it's a pretty good insurance policy. If this naltrexone's in your body for several months, it's an insurance policy against relapse.
Right. Yeah, because I imagine that's a biggie is relapse. Person, gets clean. You hear it all the time. Oh, I was clean for 6 months, and now they're using again. So relapse is probably pretty common, isn't it?
Well, and tell me this, because always it's cost, right? We always have a cost factor. So we had talked originally, the whole reason this came up was about use through the Veterans Administration and how this could help combat the opioid crisis. So from a cost standpoint, putting someone on this medication versus this injectable type, or what do you call it, an implant, what's the difference between the two? Is it huge, or
is
it deal breaker?
The prices are all over the place depending on
the
position and what sort of treatment. That's like saying, how much is it going to cost for me to treat and manage your diabetes for your life?
Sure.
Your life.
But is it one of those things that they'll use?
No, they're not going to be different. But to give you ideas, I can give you kind of like some averages and what's out there now. So the typical traditional 30 days in a residential rehab, which has kind of been the standard or what's been known forever, is, go to rehab.
Right.
That 30-day rehab, residential rehab, around the country on average is about $27,500 a month. That's the typical cost for 30 days in a rehab setting, and it ranges everywhere. I mean, it could be much cheaper, of course, and if you're in, here in California and in Malibu, you could be spending $80,000 a month. That's for the rich and famous,
right,
of course. They can range, and that's for 30 days of residential rehab, which is, okay, you know, some people need to be in that type of setting to be out of their environment to get clean and detox. But that's really not treatment. That's the beginning of treatment, just like going to detox is. But that's not treatment and management. So now that we remember this is a disease now, you manage diseases. You try to cure them or you manage them. So this is so this is why these 30-day rehabs are just kind of the beginning of that process. Now, when it comes to, you know, implants, or our program, for example, our program is called the BioCorrect Recovery Program. So what we've done is we have our particular implant that's been used for about 7 years in the U.S. and even longer in Australia, about twice as long. We've developed an entire behavioral program around that that includes peer support, counseling, therapy, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, all of those things, and we offer that to independent treatment providers around the country. They, in turn, use that, and they price that however they like, depending on the individual, because sometimes they have to do detox. Some patients are more hands-on. You know, there's a lot of people that are involved in the care of one individual. So to give you an idea of the range, it's usually, from what we hear from the field, anywhere from about $8,000 or $9,000 to the low teens, maybe 12,500, 14,000, somewhere in there. It can range anywhere in there for a program that includes the implant therapy, but all of the counseling, all of the peer support, all of the medical care and follow-up, you know, the procedure itself, removing stitches, you know, the H&Ps, everything involved. So from soup to nuts, you're in about that range. So if you compare that to a 30-day rehab,
yeah,
you can see, you can do the comparison there.
Besides the fact that it lasts longer than 30 days, and I would imagine you're... When we come back, can we talk about success rate? Do you have enough data for that?
Sure.
Yeah, because I'm going to put my wager in now.
Yeah.
On success rate.
Happy to.
Very good. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Sometimes I feel like my only friend is the city I live in, the city of angels. Lonely as I am, together we cry. I drive on the streets 'cause she's my companion. I walk through the hills 'cause she knows who I am. She sees my good deeds and she kisses the wind. Well, I never worry, now that is a lie.
Got the poison, I've got the remedy. The remedy is the experience. This is a dangerous liaison. I says the comedy is that a serious. This is a strange enough new play on words. I said the tragedy is how you're gonna spend the rest of your nights with the light on. So shine the light on all of your friends. Well, it all amounts to nothing in the end. I won't worry.
Nice. I knew you'd have a plethora of music for us, Bob. All right, Brady, take us through this. So if you have somebody in your family or friend network, how do they get on track with this? I mean, especially you live out in the middle of nowhere. If you live in downtown LA, I'm sure you have a lot of choices. But let's just say you live in somewhere else that doesn't have, you know, massive medical options for this kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, and that's kind of our, you know, our goal with BioCorrects is making this program as easily accessible as possible. Because that's one of the big challenges with addiction treatment, as you said, it's access to care is a big issue. Wanting care is probably a bigger issue than access to care.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a whole other story there.
You're talking about drug and alcohol abuse, but let's just say maybe you got a parent of a kid. And
well, the first thing I'd say is, you know, our website, beataddiction.com, is an 888 number there, and there's also, anyone can call, and there's also a page where you can look at where locations and where our particular program is available. And right now, I believe we're in about 12 states around the country, maybe 36 or so locations overall, heavily on the East Coast, in California, we have availability in 2 or 3 locations. But in kind of sporadically in between. But that's the best thing, is someone can go and see where, call the number, or find out if there's a place locally. Now, people travel all over the world to get these types of implants, and they're available in different countries. So that's the beauty, I guess, of this treatment is someone can potentially go to their family practitioner, coordinate it with a location that's nearest them to get with an implant provider, get their all their preparatory work done. They can come in for a day to get the procedure and go back home and then have their physician do the follow-up care. And then that can be done as quickly as just, you know, a drive, or we're trying to have this program available at an hour or two drive or car or a short plane ride in the short term. But then once they get the implant, and it's working in their body for several months, then we help to get all of their behavioral care set up, which is the most important part of this program for their for the longevity of recovery and sobriety. And that can be done in several ways. We can link them with a counselor that's trained in our behavioral program in their local market. But if there is none and they're really rural, we have telecounseling available. Which is, you know, telemedicine is also the wave of the future.
And telemedicine has become very, very popular with the Veterans Administration, and so far seems actually be working well. I was kind of surprised.
Well, it works well for certain issues, right? I mean, it's you can't stitch someone through telemedicine just yet, but
the one that really surprised me was dermatology. Very, very popular, because I guess the camera that they shine on whatever the skin thing or focus on the skin thing, I guess the doctor can actually see it better through the camera than they would even with their naked eye. And I thought, okay, now I've heard everything.
Yeah, that's right. Well, similarly, when you think about mental health in general, you know, you don't need to touch someone to treat them for mental health. So it's probably one of the you know, the best suited uses of telemedicine. And not only that, it's about convenience. If there's some studies that have been done, I can't cite them because I don't know off the top of my head, but that telecounseling or teletherapy for behavioral health versus face-to-face, the outcomes were the same. Now, and one might argue that people, since you're making this convenient, think about it, driving to a counselor or a therapist,
right,
sit down there for an hour, that's not convenient. You know, when you could do it from your computer and you can do a session for 45 minutes, an hour, even 30 minutes, and some argue that you get more out of a 30-minute telecounseling session than a face-to-face hour, because you kind of get to the point, you know, you're saving time from commuting and there's not a lot of small talk. You get to the issues and you have a really good attentive session, and it's convenient for all. So this lends itself well for those that obviously have access to the internet to do this. That's the other challenge, I guess, of rural areas. But this day and age, most people have access to an iPhone or can borrow one. But so that's how we're also addressing the topic we're talking about now, is accessibility. So if we can get someone to travel for a day to get the implant, that's a huge. Then we can handle the rest of them remotely. So that's part of how, you know, we offer that as options.
That's a cool idea. Because I'm looking, like, here on the West Coast, I'm looking at your list, and okay, so you have L.A., you have Lakewood, you have Medford. So for those of us in the northern part of the state, Medford, Oregon is close. And go up just a little ways further, and, you know, you're into Portland. And so you guys are spaced out pretty nicely on the West Coast, and you've got places all over the place. Pennsylvania and Arkansas and Indiana.
We need more. I mean, we'd love to have hundreds of them available to make it even more convenient. It's all about, look, Rick,
it's really all about
reducing the barriers to treatment.
Yeah.
And accessibility is one of them. The other barrier is desire, motivation to get help, which is I think even harder. I think we'll overcome the accessibility one over time.
Sure.
But getting people to want to get into treatment is the bigger, I think the bigger issue.
Well, one of the things we were kind of chatting about yesterday while we were discussing some of this, you know, I could see this as being an option for some of the court-ordered stuff, because I don't know about where you are, but where we are, there's no jail space, and we don't have, you know, abundant, you know, mental health facilities. They're filled with people who oftentimes are, you know, criminal offenders, and it's just not always a good fit for this kind of thing. But this, I mean, is it possible this could become an option for court-ordered drug treatment?
It's very possible, and those are the things we're trying to accomplish. I mean, there's a lot of bureaucracy in all of this stuff.
Sure.
It's usually a bigger challenge. But we are making some headway, and we're keep on beating down the doors, because it is. I mean, you look at California, I think the cost for 1 year of incarceration is $75,000, give or take.
It's still cheaper than rehab. Obviously, with the staggering numbers you gave us.
What's that?
Yeah, I said it's still cheaper than rehab with some of the staggering numbers you gave us. We had no idea.
Yeah, but those rehabs are being paid for usually privately.
Sure.
And there's high-end rehabs where this is, we're funding this as taxpayers.
Right, right.
So California is one of the highest numbers for incarceration. I think most other states kind of, you know, Midwest and South, you may be in, you know, 19,000, 20,000. Still a lot of money.
It's a ton of money.
But that money would be better served going towards treatment for those drug offenders and keeping them out of prison. And not only that, have them be a productive member of society.
So somebody has, if they only do this one time, if they do the implant one time, they have, let's say, just for round numbers, like 4 to 6 months where they literally will not be able to use drugs because it makes them ill. So they have that time to get it out of their system, to kind of get, depending on what was going on in their world before, maybe, you know, get their head on straight. I realize relapse and all that stuff has to do with the person, so it might be kind of hard to measure, but that versus, like, you have to take a pill every day or you have to go to counseling every day or something like that, I would think this would be much more successful.
Well, you think so, right? It's about convenience for everyone involved. I mean, it's kind of...
Well, it takes away your choices for...
We don't want to paint this as a cure,
right,
or a quick fix.
But boy, if you had if you were somebody who, say, was an athlete and got hooked on pain medication and went, you know, just got sucked into that vortex, a good 4 to 6 months out of that,
you're back on track.
Yeah, I mean, you're literally not having to reinvent yourself. You're just kind of clawing your way back to where you were before. Darn it, we have to celebrate capitalism again here.
Crutch,
for 2 minutes,
whatever you want to call it. But you guys be clear, it's not preventing people from doing drugs and they get sick if they do it. It's taking away a lot of the cravings or the desire.
Yeah,
if they do use certain drugs, they won't feel the effects.
Yeah, they're going to want to.
People will test it. People will test this thing. Environment's a big part of it. If you put someone back in their environment, even if you take away their cravings, there's a habitual part of this as well.
Right.
So they need to really be committed to life changes. But this really gives them that opportunity to make some better choices. And let's use the best of this 4 to 6 month window or so. And let's all hands on deck and let's see what we can do in these 4 or 6 months. And if they need a subsequent implant, which we don't see much of in our case, especially with alcoholism, then it's there. That crutch is there. They need a little bit more time, but we don't really want to promote that this is what you should be doing forever. Let's get to the underlying issues. Let's have you get strong enough to deal with life stressors.
Well, it'd be kind of awesome to be a counselor partnered with this. You'd actually feel like you had a fighting chance
to get them over the hump.
It's funny, my daughter's a drug and alcohol counselor. I have to ask her if she knows about this. She's in rural Maine.
Well, let's take a real quick break, and then
yeah.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit more about the
short celebration of capitalism, and then we'll be right back. And beataddiction.com is their website, beataddiction.com. Be right back. You're listening to We the People.
My eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of years without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
Well, he stays away a lot now from the parties and the clubs. And he's thinking while he's jogging around, sure is glad he quit the hard drugs. Cause him and his kind get more endangered every day, and pretty soon the species will just up and fade away. Like the smoke from that torpedo, just up and fade away. Yeah, he's an old hippie and he don't know what to do. Should he hang on to the old? Should he grab on to the new?
Oh, there you go. Just in case your webpage at beataddiction.com needs a theme song, that's possible for you.
There you go. Grab all them old hippies.
Oh, my gosh. So, Brady, who's using this, just out of curiosity? Old people, young people, everybody?
All ages. All ages. There's a lot of young people that are using it because, fortunately, they still have parents that can afford it. And then there's those...
three cheers for
middle
parents,
age,
huh?
More higher functioning, you know, addicts. Well, we don't call them addicts anymore. More functioning, you know.
But we know what that means.
From this addiction, you know, they are unfortunately the people that no longer have support because a lot of people lose their family support and everything. Those people, unfortunately, aren't able to get the help. So that's the challenge. It runs all ages. But who's actually getting it is those who can afford it. I mean, that's the problem.
And yeah. have you seen an uptick in usage in the last few years, or
uptick in demand?
Yes,
more
yeah,
than usage. There's definitely demand and desire from many people, many doctors even that are treating individuals. They can only treat with those methods and medications that are paid for by the government, or someone's
right.
paying, by any payer. So, you know, we talked to many addiction medicine doctors that tell us all the time, look, if this was covered, I would put implants on all my patients because it's logical sense, right? It's
right.
Like I'd get it in them, and I don't have to worry about it for several months. You know, so that's the challenge. It's really people want it.
And is that
the coverage?
That was my next question. Is what about insurance companies? Are they typically
are they receptive to this?
You see some, you know, a little bit of light there. I mean, it's so fragmented. I mean, right now, some PPO insurances are paying, you know, for this around the country, but it's very sporadic, and you can't really, you know, it's still out of pockets required. And
sure.
Again, if someone has PPO insurance, they probably still have some sort of resources, right?
Sure.
So
what about all these
in the PPO market?
Well, since we've got like a minute left, sorry, I hate to leave this for the last minute, but I know most of us have all these people in our towns that are just, I mean, it's kind of turning into, you know, Night of the Living Dead. They're kind of wandering around, and some are getting in trouble, some are not. See any, I don't know, avenue to help us help those folks that have no means whatsoever?
Yeah, it's tough, right? It's a big problem. It's a tough, difficult one to solve. While we've been talking all day about, you know, the implant and naltrexone and how that's great for you know, for keeping people from relapsing. But there are other medications like buprenorphine and methadone, for example. Those are the other two big medications for what they call medication-assisted treatment. Sometimes those are a better route for individuals who simply can't get clean and detox or can't afford this antagonist treatment like naltrexone. It tends to be more expensive than some of the other options out there like buprenorphine, but that also has its own challenges. But sometimes people need to be stabilized and some of these other things, and then maybe naltrexone could be for them in the future. So for those types of individuals, I mean, it's all about, you know, helping them. You know, if they can't afford access,
right,
then, you know, they need to find some treatment available that is free. And they should look at government websites like SAMHSA and things like that, and look for those servers. But they have, again, they have to want it.
Yes.
They have to want sometimes, to get help.
Sometimes if there's somebody in their
help,
family.
They still want to get help. It's out there.
Well, we are grateful for the information. Thank you so much. People can find all of that at beataddiction.com, BEAT addiction.com. There's a phone number. We've got Brady's Twitter information on our website. And keep us posted on this, will you?
Yeah, like at any time. There's always a lot to talk about, unfortunately.
You can be our medical guy.
Thanks. I'm used to that.
Thanks a million. All right, guys. We'll see you next
Thank
week.
Thank you, guys.
You're listening to We the People. Archive will be up shortly at wethepeopleradio.us.